And now, for our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents Vada's War by Elizabeth Moon. Book 5. Victory Conditions, Part 1. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Colleen Delaney, Sherry Simpson, Joe Brack, Christopher Sheeran, Elizabeth Jernigan, Jeff Allen, Lily Beacon, Jeff Baker, Andy Clements, Michael Glenn, Richard Rowan, Elliot Dash, Thomas Penny, Stephen Carpenter, David Coyne, James Konacek, Eric Messner, Ren Casey, James Lewis, Casey Platt, Dylan Lynch, Mort Shelby, Ken Jackson, Danny Gavigan, Drew Copus, Sonny Lasky, Terrence Aselford, Michael John Casey, and Scott McCormick.
Kai Vada glanced around the table at the captains crowded into her office. It still felt a little unreal, but here they were, all waiting for her to say something. Argelos and Pettigrew, there from the beginning. Yamini, who had been Argelos's military advisor, and who now captained the stealth observer they'd captured from the pirates. Ransom and Baskerville, the two surviving captains of Ransom's Rangers. Major Douglas of Mackensee Military Assistance Corporation, assigned as M. Mac's liaison to her. His assistant, Master Sergeant Callie Pitt, seemed quite at ease standing in a corner.
Our main problem, as I see it, is that we're always reacting to Turek. We don't know much about him, what his goals are, besides killing people and getting power. And we can't understand any of the transmissions we've overheard. We've got to find a way to get better intel.
Major Douglas smiled at Kai.
Mackensee might share data with you if you don't mind me butting in.
I don't mind. Before we go into jump, would you like to ask them about that?
You particularly want information about their language and any history anyone can dig up, is that right?
Oh, I wouldn't mind knowing where they are right now, where they're going next, and in what force.
If we knew that, we'd be hauling mass. All of us. And I can ask if any of our linguists know the language. You gave them copies of the transmissions, right?
I did, yes. And another thing. I know I need a staff structure. We talked about that before, but with over 40 ships to command, I need something now, before we get to Cascadia.
Think any of those privateers will give you trouble?
Kai was mildly amused that Argelos, a former privateer himself, no longer considered himself one of them.
I doubt it. Aunt Grace sent them. She'd have checked them out.
You don't just need a staff, you need a combat control center. You can't command 40 ships from the bridge on this ship. It's too crowded. And it doesn't have the right communication set up. Your shipboard ansibles are an incredible advance, but they can't do everything, and they're bulky.
My office...
isn't adequate.
Yamini nodded at Douglas.
I agree with Major Douglas. Running the additional communications cables in here would be next to impossible, and they must be shielded cables. You're talking over 40 ships now, and maybe more if the Moscow Confederation sent ships from Cascadia. That's a lot of equipment, not just for communications, but also for scan, if you're to have the data you need during a battle. I don't know how you'd get one in this ship. You'd have to practically rebuild it, I'd think. But then you've told us it needs serious work anyway.
On our ships, the CCC is built in when the hulls are laid. But I understand that some systems have modular CCCs that can be retrofitted to vessels. We don't, but maybe they can do that at Cascadia.
Before we go into FTL, we should ask Stella about that.
Kai added another line to the list in her implant. A long list now, since she had heard about the Slaughter Key privateers on their way to Cascadia, turned down Mackenzie's offer of a commission, and accepted the suggestion of a liaison to travel with her. In a few short hours, her little group would leave the Mackenzie headquarters world and head for Cascadia Station, and she would have to be ready when they arrived to take charge in reality as the commander she had hoped to become.
We'll have two jump transitions on the way. You want communication there or not?
They're both just waypoints, aren't they? Uninhabited systems?
Yes, but the Ansibles are up in both right now. We might find out what's going on.
Good idea. We don't want to delay any more than we have to, but stripping bulletins from Ansibles doesn't take long. Everyone should do it, so you can each run your own analysis and we can share. Intership communication only by onboard Ansibles, no matter how close we are.
Captain?
Yes, Hugh?
Last load's coming aboard here, Captain. Last for Shara's gift is a half hour out. Mackenzie's traffic control officer has given us a priority departure slot in 2.5 hours. Next after that's at 3.5. Thought you'd want to know.
Thanks, Hugh. We'd better get at it, hadn't we? I'd like to take that early slot, so this meeting will have to be short.
For another hour, they hammered out the organization of skeleton staff to be filled out once they arrived at Cascadia, then dispersed to their various ships. Kai made the calls courtesy required to the Mackenzie officers who had assisted them, sent data burst messages to Stella, Grace, and Rafe, and then went to the bridge as they undocked and headed out toward the jump point. Rafe Dunbarger, acting CEO of Interstellar Communications, looked at the monitor in the central control room of ISC's detention center. The man in the security cell looked older than his official years and very tired. All the gloss of wealth and power had leached away, leaving his face exposed, the dissatisfaction and ambition clear to see. Rafe turned to his new internal security chief. Despite the fact that Gary had been the bane of his existence when they were in school together, he had masterminded the rescue of Rafe's family. Rafe could think of no one else, other than Kai, that he trusted more with his personal safety.
You sure you got everything?
As sure as we can be. His implant was coded as self-destructive, removed, of course. But we were able to block that and examine it. Downloaded everything we could. And before we took his implant, we'd done a full panel, except what you told us not to.
I have my reasons.
Oh, I'm sure, Sir Dunbarger. Not arguing, just saying.
Rafe watched the man on the monitor shift his weight on the narrow bed. Now came the question, the final question at the end of all the data collection. What to do with the man who destroyed his childhood and much of his adulthood, who separated him from his father? How to deal with the man who schemed and plotted and finally tried to kill Garston Dunbarger, a man who had treated him like another son? What was a fitting punishment for the man who contrived the killing of his sisters, the death of his surviving sister's husband and child?
He surely deserves death, but what death could encompass his crimes? And what about legal procedures?
Rafe had made discreet inquiries, and the answer came back that it was ISC's problem. The government didn't want a noisy, embarrassing, expensive trial any more than he did. They wanted the problem removed. He'd been told the man was a 100% liability. But Rafe had been told that about himself when it wasn't true. It might not ever be true. The man had intelligence, talents, charisma. He had earned the trust of the board, of Rafe's father. He might have been, in some way, as misunderstood, or at least as complex, as Rafe himself.
Would have been easier to kill him that first day.
True.
No matter what he did, leaving Louis Parmina alive would be too dangerous. The man was a threat, not only to him and his family, but also to ISC, Nexus, and the New Alliance. In the heat of his early rage, he could have enjoyed killing the man himself. But now his stomach churned at the thought.
You're gonna tell him?
He expects it. He's not stupid.
Well, they always hope.
I'll speak to him.
Rafe wasn't sure why he felt that he must, but he knew if he didn't, he would regret it forever.
Not without a guard.
No, I'm not stupid either. And not you. I'll take whoever's on duty in the section.
Rafe let the guard open the cell and then followed him in. The guard stepped to one side, stun rod ready. Lou Parmina's gaze flicked to the guard and back to Rafe's face.
Enjoying yourself, aren't you? Still a scared little boy, aren't we?
Cautious. You might take it as a sign of respect.
Lou put his hands behind his head. The guard shifted slightly, watchful.
Not from me. Having fun with the company. I left you a few surprises.
As much as possible.
My family?
Are fine.
No conjugal visit before the end.
She refused.
Parmina's wife had done more than refuse. She had gone into hysterics at the mention of that possibility.
Ah. Well then, I presume this is the obligatory so long, farewell, see you in hell session. Or are you going to go all mushy and ask why I betrayed your father's trust?
I have no interest in why you did it.
Well then, get it over with. Unless you're planning to drag it out with torture or something. I know you. You can't pretend you don't enjoy killing.
Rafe smiled down at him, holding Parmina's gaze until the man had to look down.
I ration myself.
He nodded to the guard, who opened the door and turned to leave.
You coward!
Even as Rafe spun, drawing his own weapon, the guard's stunner struck Lou. He collapsed, clawing at his neck.
Go on, sir. I'll take care of this.
Rafe holstered his pistol.
Quickly. No playtime.
Absolutely.
Rafe waited in the corridor outside. After a moment, the guard emerged.
Autopsy?
No. The family has requested no autopsy and no funeral. I'd say dispose of the body to medical research, except that he might have hidden something else nasty internally. If you can remove the implant in a secure facility, do that. Direct cremation safest. Be sure to fill out the paperwork.
Back in his office, Rafe made the necessary calls. Lou's wife cried, more with relief than sorrow, but he still felt compelled to comfort her. The daughter Lou had abused listened stony-faced. Rafe's sister Penny nodded once, then burst into tears, clearly relief this time. And his mother, on the comm, did the same. Official reaction was subdued, but clearly glad that ISC had handled ISC's problem. He felt none of the exultation he had before, only a peculiar sense of loss that he finally identified as grief. Lou Parmina was dead, and deservedly so, but he had been as human as Rafe himself. He thought suddenly of Kai and her moment of compassion for the spy they had caught on her ship. She would have understood this.
How could someone have gone so wrong?
Rafe informed the board that afternoon at their regular meeting.
Lou Parmina is dead. He tried to attack me in the cell. A guard killed him. The death was reported to all the proper authorities. The family declined to receive the remains or hold a funeral. They asked that ISC dispose of them. He was cremated immediately.
About time, poisonous creature.
Václav Box had urged the need for Parmina's death more than once. Others nodded agreement. No one wanted to be seen as defending Parmina.
Next, the latest medical report on my father.
At first, they had demanded such reports almost daily, but lately he had noticed more time between questions and less apparent interest.
His speech has improved, though slowly. His doctors, however, hold out no hope that he will be able to take up his duties as CEO even part-time within the next 4 months. And they do not think he will ever be able to use an internal implant.
Not even on the other side?
Apparently not. Because of the existing damage, they're concerned that any manipulation to create the pocket could cause seizures, or worse. An external device might be possible, but he had had a right-sided implant his whole life.
Rafe looked down for a moment, imagining what it must be like without an implant, without that reassuring presence.
We had all hoped, of course, that the neural regeneration would proceed more swiftly.
Then Rafe could have gotten back to his own life, though he had no idea what that life might be. Glances passed back and forth across the table. For a long moment, no one said anything.
About your father.
Yes?
You know I've talked to him. So have some of the others. I'm certainly aware he's not what he was. And for the most part, we don't want him back.
Box paused a moment, clearly trying to gauge Rafe's reaction. Rafe felt as if a load of rock had dropped on his head. He couldn't think of anything to say.
I'm one of his oldest friends. I still consider him a friend. But he got us into this whole mess. His judgment was faulty long before his injury. Or perhaps it had been tampered with. But that doesn't really matter.
You've canvassed the board?
Rafe looked around at them all.
Informally, yes.
You can't blame everything on him. It was Lou.
He was fooled by Parmina to the point of repudiating his own son. The policies he approved led directly to the mess we're in now. The erosion of our ability to protect our monopoly, the failure to gain control of new technology, the theft of our intellectual property. Parmina may have been the mastermind, but your father did not see the dangers.
Neither had the board. They had all been fooled just as much as Rafe's father. They'd never done anything more than nod yes and take their compensation.
Then, if you don't want my father, you won't want me.
Not at all, Rafe. You did see the problems. You've clarified them for all of us. You've started turning the corporation around. We need you, and we want you. Now, and for the foreseeable future. I don't believe, and I'm sure the board concurs, that there is anyone else who could possibly save as much of what we had.
The others nodded. The weight fell back on his shoulders. He wanted to yell at them, insist he was not the one for the job. But he knew he was.
The only problem is this thing with the Vada family and your relationship with them. On this, I stand with your father, and I think I speak for most of the board. There are reasons to be concerned. They are involved in too many of the things that have gone wrong, that have cost us.
You can't seriously believe that...
Rafe faced that double row of stony faces. They did believe it. He would have to change that. They would have to understand that their future lay with a Vata alliance. Stella Vata, acting CEO of Vata Transport, watched a crawler line move across the screen of her desk comp, silenced, as she liked it, and flicked for full download. The columns of figures she'd been working on faded. The screen showed a newsman from Central Cascadian News Service standing in front of another screen, which showed an explosion repeating over and over.
Just in. A vid apparently sent by Ansible to at least a dozen system governments. We're not sure of the source, but analysis suggests that it is, as it claims, an actual unedited vid. The person you will see identifies himself as Gamis Turek and claims to represent a large force. I must warn you, this vid contains disturbing images and language, unsuitable for children. But we feel it is urgent.
Stella felt cold to her bones. Gamis Turek. The man Kai insisted had been connected to Osman Vada and the attack on their family. And behind the disruption of the Ansible network and the conquest of systems like Bissonette and Polson. The screen changed, so the explosion filled it. This time it did not repeat, but changed to a man in a dark red and black uniform, standing against a background of a night sky, arms folded across his chest. He seemed tall, though without any background clues, it was impossible to say how tall. Dark-haired, dark-eyed, a strong-boned face that might have been attractive if not for the expression. He seemed to be looking through the camera, right into Stella's eyes. She felt exposed for a moment, even though she knew he could not possibly see her. He had to have personality mods to convey that much command presence in a recording.
You will all know my name. You will all fear my name. I am Gamis Turek. You must understand this. I can isolate your world at any moment. My fleets control the spaceways. My forces can disrupt Ansible communications whenever I wish. I have many allies. Their forces, too, are at my command. I have more ships than any system militia, and weapons that can turn your homeworlds into cinders. If you force me to use them against you, I will have no mercy. You and those you love, everything you have worked for will die in an instant. Here is one proof of it.
Now the scene showed an expansive office where well-dressed civilians, all clearly Humods, backed away from armed men wearing Turek's maroon and black colors.
They argued with my command.
The scene shifted to a brief battle between a rock-throwing mob and the soldiers.
They did not obey. That was Pulse. I own it now. I own its jump points. I own its ansibles. Only my people live on the world once called Pulse. And it is not the only one.
The scene changed to a ruined city, smoke rising from shattered buildings.
Here, someone killed one of my men. Just one. Hundreds died here. Maybe thousands. It doesn't matter to me. I do not tolerate disobedience.
The scene shifted again, this time to an image of an Ansible platform exploding, then again to Turek standing as before.
Do not make the mistake of thinking this is an idle boast, or that you can save yourselves by banding together. It is too late for that. My agents are everywhere. Those of you who conspire against me will regret it.
He smiled, a chilling smile that was at the same time alluring. Stella remembered from her brief bad affair what strings were being pulled here.
Remember my name. Expect me. I am coming.
The announcer reappeared.
We have no way of knowing whether this is some kind of scam or whether this person really exists and actually is behind the recent disturbing events we reported some time ago. The apparent overthrow of the governments of Bissonette and Pulsen by a foreign force. But we felt this was important enough to bring to the public. We have already sent this vid to the Moscow Confederation Defense Department, who are now analyzing it further. We will keep you informed.
Stella tabbed back to the spreadsheet she'd been working on. Cascadia felt a lot less safe than it had a few minutes ago. She had been so sure that nothing would happen here until Kai reappeared, and then Kai would take care of it. Or someone would. And she could go on leading Vata Enterprises and Vata Transport. And there was nothing she could do, really, except make sure that new onboard Ansibles came off the production line as fast as possible. One production line might not be enough. She might as well work on costing a proposal. 10 minutes later, her implant scheduler reminded her that her ward, Toby, would be back soon from school. Foreign crisis or no foreign crisis, she could not put off any longer a serious talk about a purely personal matter. She waited until Toby had engulfed his usual after-school snack before broaching the topic she knew would upset him.
Toby, I need to speak to you about your friendship with Zori.
Why?
Her family isn't happy with it, for one thing. If you were both older, that wouldn't matter. Well, it wouldn't matter on Slaughter Key. I'm not sure what the courtship rituals are on such a courteous place as this. But you're not older, and her family has a right to influence her choices.
Toby's face settled into a stubborn expression. Zori was his first girlfriend, and he had fallen as hard as a boy his age could fall.
She likes me.
Yes, so I gather from her mother. But their concern is twofold. We are not an old Cascadian family, and we are the wrong religion.
We can't help it that we just got here. It's not like we're criminals or anything.
This was a part of the caution common to prominent families that Stella had not understood herself at Toby's age, and her own stubbornness had caused no end of trouble.
No, but they're just being careful of her, Toby. They think, right or wrong, that she will be happier with someone of her own kind. Someone whose family they know.
She doesn't care about those boys. She cares about me.
That may be, but it doesn't change the fact that her family would prefer she not care about you that much.
We're not doing anything. All we did was kind of, you know, I mean, I touched her hair.
Stella knew to the marrow of her bones what Toby was feeling, and also what magnitude of trouble that could cause.
They're her parents. You don't want to get her in trouble.
No, of course not, but they...
are her parents. Look, I've had two long talks with her mother. Explained...
telling Toby she'd told Zori's mother that the two were in no danger, that it was their first attraction, that they'd get out of it faster if the parents stayed calm, would only make Toby determined to prove how serious they were and how permanent their affection.
I explained that we were a respectable, even prominent family on Slaughter Key, that you were a responsible young man. They're not accusing you or her of anything wrong. They agree that you're intelligent and well-mannered, but they're adamant that she quit visiting here unless I guarantee adult supervision, and even then, not more than twice a week.
Here? But it's our office! It's a public place! It doesn't even have a bed!
Though not because he hadn't asked for one, so he could stay overnight working on his projects. Stella forbore to remind him of that.
Toby, this isn't about you specifically. It's their culture, their family, their daughter.
He had hardened his jaw, but now he nodded slowly.
I suppose. I should be glad that they didn't forbid her to visit at all.
You're right. And they want to meet both of us. Two meetings. One with me alone, and one just you and her parents.
Zori didn't say anything.
She may not know yet. And for this meeting, she won't be coming. Her mother suggested lunch at a nice restaurant, and I agreed. Her father may or may not make it.
When?
Tomorrow.
Can I tell...
I see no reason why you can't tell Zori today that I'm meeting her mother for lunch tomorrow. But if I were you, I wouldn't be too specific about why. Her parents have a right to tell her what they want her to know.
It's not fair to keep things from people.
It's also not fair to start trouble between members of another family.
Liking someone isn't starting trouble.
Stella shuddered at a rush of all too vivid memories.
It can be.
Stella arrived at the Glade, the restaurant Zori's mother had suggested, a few minutes early. Her security team ran its usual check, and she signed them in with the maitre d'.
Sarah and Sarah Luari aren't here yet, if the Sarah would like to wait in the lounge.
Thank you.
Stella was glad of a few quiet moments alone to collect herself. The morning had been a chaotic scramble, as worried officials demanded to know when Ansible's on order could be delivered, and where Kai was, and when the promised Slaughter Key ships would arrive. News outlets had played Turek's speech over and over. Normally courteous Cascadians were even snapping at one another and at Stella. The familiar dance of family relationships could not be as stressful as her morning, even if it turned out badly for Toby. The lounge extended the Cascadian theme of forest design to include a floor covering that looked, felt, and smelled like a carpet of real moss, a sound system projecting the rustle of leaves in the breeze and birdsong, and visuals that produced moving shadows and lights on the surfaces, as if sun glimmered through leaves. Stella appreciated the artistry, but wished some decorator would choose another theme. A beach, perhaps, or a mountain lake, or a meadow full of bright flowers. Surely the planet wasn't all forested.
Ah, Saravata!
The woman who came into the lounge was older, and had once been in Stella's class of beauty, but dark-haired, like Zori. Now she had the thin, brittle look of someone fighting a long illness or under great stress. Her ice-green suit fit perfectly. Her jewelry was obviously expensive, but not flashy.
Sarah Luari, what a pleasure.
Stella knew she was being examined and evaluated in the same way she looked at Zori's mother. Hair, manicure, makeup, clothes, jewelry, shoes. She had correctly guessed the right level, and Sarah Luari acknowledged that with the briefest change in expression. As far as fashion went, they were equals.
I'm not sure if my husband will make it. He sent me a message. Something at work had come up.
I quite understand. Should we wait in case...
Sarah Luari sat upright on the edge of her chair.
A few minutes only, if you don't mind. He said if he was not here in 10 minutes, he would not be coming. But...
You have a charming daughter.
I hope she hasn't been too forward. She's vivacious sometimes. She speaks out. Her father, he indulges her.
Stella wondered if the woman was ill, or if meeting her daughter's boyfriend's guardian was really such a strain.
Not at all forward. Very polite, I would think, by the standards of your world as well as mine.
Would you tell me something of your, I assume, Toby's world?
I grew up on planet. The main family house was in the country, though my father's business took him to the city much of the time.
Stella noticed that Sarah Luari's face relaxed, and wondered if it was because of the country or the city.
Slaughter Key has 4 main continents, and a lot of good-sized islands. The family as a whole has teak plantations on several subtropical islands, but we lived in a temperate zone. Stone fruits in our orchards, lovely in the spring. My cousin Kai... You have heard of her, I know. Lived on one of the tropical islands with reefs just offshore on the east side. We visited each other often.
You could grow old earth stone fruits in quantity?
Oh, yes. Exported the fruit and nursery stock off-world. For some reason, the result of terraforming there worked for all the Rose family plants, and our family lands had varied terrain, so we could grow just about all of them. The first time I went out system, I was amazed to find that not all planets could grow them, even after terraforming.
Oh, you must have traveled a lot, and so young. Did your family approve?
Stella explained, as if no one could be expected to have done research. The family business, the habit of sending young people out to sample the universe.
I also grew up on planet. My family had timberland. We export hardwoods, you know. The native vegetation, not Terran.
But for food?
Oh, farmlands terraformed, of course. But not the forests. The native trees have incredible wood. My family were firsters. We had a grant that covered all the ground from the coast to the inland range for 1,000 kilometers.
We called them chartered. The first colonists on Slaughter Key. Vada's chartered.
You are? Oh, but that's the same.
If I understand firsters... Your family goes back to the Colony Foundation, and you were investors, right?
Now, Sarah Luari sat back a little, and her smile widened.
Right. And your nephew, he grew up the same?
Not exactly. His parents live in another system, running a branch operation. I'm not really familiar with his home world.
My husband's business also operates in multiple systems. But you're not married?
No.
And your family doesn't mind? They do not press you for an alliance with another?
My family is mostly dead. But my father wanted me to have experience, he said, before I married. If I married.
Zori is too young to marry.
Stella just managed not to laugh.
So is Toby, of course. But young people, they will form attachments.
Sarah Luari's gaze wandered away and back.
I think my husband is not coming, and we should go in to lunch.
Cascadian custom prohibited business discussion at most meals, certainly in a place like the Glade. And Stella wondered if the follies of youth were considered business. Through the appetizer, Sarah Luari said nothing of the youngsters, commenting only on the food. With the next course, she made a few comments about Zori's upbringing, the importance of their traditional religious rites.
And your family?
We are not of the same faith as you. But if I understand correctly, yours originated from the Modulin, did it not?
Oh, our beliefs are also descended from Modulins. So, you are opposed to unnecessary conflict? Our emphasis on courtesy and serenity does not seem excessive to you?
Not at all.
Not until dessert came did Sarah Luwari bring up the matter at hand, taking a small mouthful of berry pie.
I shouldn't be eating this. My husband and I do not wish to become plump, you understand.
Stella, already halfway through her own pie, thought Sarah Luwari was already over thin. She wondered if her husband liked her that way. And what, in Cascadian custom, would be the polite response?
I am reassured by what you tell me of your family, and having met you, by you yourself. It did bother us that you were only Toby's guardian, not his mother. I understand the events that made that necessary, and I apologize for being influenced by the unfortunate revelations in that legal matter.
A tactful way of saying that Stella was a notorious criminal's bastard. Stella admired the woman's euphemistic skirting of brutal fact.
It certainly came as a surprise to me.
Oh, of course. And your adoptive family was, both from what you say and by the evidence of your own behavior, what we could hope for in one of Zori's companions. I hope you do not find our concern too offensive.
Not at all. Your daughter is a lovely girl, and any responsible parent would be concerned.
Stella thought about adding that she was equally concerned that Zori be suitable for Toby, but decided it might be construed as an insufficiently veiled insult.
We would very much like to have Toby visit us at home when my husband is there, perhaps for lunch. Not a school day, of course.
I'm sure he would be delighted.
Sarah Luwari suggested the next non-school day, and Stella accepted on Toby's behalf. She returned to the office refreshed. Though there were monsters loose in the universe, boys and girls still fell in love, and parents and guardians still schemed to keep them safe. Toby picked up slang as easily as any other information, and Zori Luwari, out of class, had a colorful collection of words that sounded like nothing else. She nudged him with an elbow and glanced at a schoolmate neither of them much liked. Bortan asked questions just to delay the class.
Bistim guy.
Prot.
It was like a secret language, Zori's slang, a way around Cascadia's fussy formality. And so far, no one had complained about it. Everyone had been on edge anyway, with more to worry about than adolescents using slang that might, if understood, be rude.
E-prot.
It was rude. Very rude indeed, but it was also funny. Toby grinned back.
My parents will be pleased to meet you, I'm sure. I know Mother has been...
They both knew that her mother and Toby's aunt had locked horns with the utmost courtesy and determination.
Less than understanding of your family's position back home, now that the Slaughter Key Ansible is back up.
They'll find out the family was nearly destroyed. That should definitely help.
Toby felt worse the closer they got to Zori's parents. They lived in Cascadia Station's most exclusive neighborhood, the Cone, with live trees along both sides of the pedestrian-only street. Cone Park, outside the gates, was the station's largest and held a small grove of pines. If Zori's parents wouldn't listen to Stella, he could think of no reason why they would listen to a boy under legal age. He felt much older than his official age, but he knew that did not matter. He was Stella's ward, and too young to plead his own case.
Something helped, or they wouldn't have invited you to meet them. Your cousin is still mistrustful, I see.
Zori glanced back over her shoulder. Toby could think of nothing polite to say. Stella had told him over and over why he must have security along on this social occasion. Clearly, she did not trust either station security or Zori's parents, and that was a form of insult. But he was her ward. He had to do what she said. Zori patted his arm.
Don't worry. I'm not upset with you. After what happened with your family, I can understand her feelings. But really, we're in the safest area of the station. You don't need your guards there, I promise.
I know. I know that, but she didn't just tell me. She told them. And they listened to her. How angry will your parents be?
Kafadit. Tiagribantoso. But she'll have told them, I'm sure, and they'll be upset with her, not you.
They were near the security gate now. Toby felt the prickle of sweat under his arms.
Kazurit. Zurin Far Kazurit Sim.
Oh, I wish you knew what language it was. What root, anyway.
The gate slid aside, and Zori led him through.
Commercial code, my father says. Don't you Vatas have something similar?
Yes, but it's based on one of those slaughter key languages. Extinct now. Tam something.
What the?
Toby turned around. The gate had shut before his security could get through.
What happened?
Your cousin must not have told my father that you were bringing them. The gate was set for only the two of us. Well, that's one way of getting rid of them.
The two men were glaring through the gate.
I can't. Stella would be most upset.
Zori gave him a challenging look.
My parents were most upset about you, remember? And I faced them down. Are you that...
He could see the effort she made to frame it in courteous terms.
That... Pratvin?
It's not a matter of courage.
Her brows went up, the expression on her face all scorn and utterly beautiful at once. Toby felt his heart turn over. Kazurit Adden, she'd said. She loved him. He still didn't know why she loved him, but cowardice certainly wasn't the reason. He could still feel her warm breath on his ear when she'd said it. He could still smell her fragrance.
I have to explain to them. That's only polite.
She nodded, her face relaxing now. Toby walked the few steps back to the gate.
I'm sorry, but apparently Stella didn't tell Zori's father that I would have an escort. The gate's set only for two, and Zori doesn't have the right to let anyone else in. When I get to her place, I'll ask her parents to let you in, but really, you can see, you know, it's the cone. Nothing bad happens here, I'll be fine.
You should come out, you know that. Your cousin told you...
She wants me safe. I understand that. But I'm perfectly safe here. It's the cone, after all.
It's our job. We're supposed to be with you at all times.
And they had been. And he and Zori had not been able to do anything without those watchful and, he feared, amused adult gazes on them.
I'm not coming out. I'm just going to meet Zori's parents. And it would be rude to be late. You can explain to Stella.
We certainly will.
A few minutes later, in the elegant salon of Zori's place, Toby returned the polite bow of the older man, Zori's father, whose perfectly tailored suit and polished shoes seemed impregnable as a suit of armor.
And this is my wife, Zori's mother.
He gestured to a dark-haired woman in a gown of pale green. She had not risen from her chair. Like all the others in the room, it had thin, curved legs and a narrow seat upholstered in stripes of green and cream. Toby bowed again, this time more deeply, as appropriate for a young man to an older woman. His voice broke on the formal phrase of greeting. He could feel the blood rushing to his face.
It is our pleasure to welcome our daughter's school friend.
Something in her manner reduced Toby to the level of a grubby schoolboy, the age to have sweets stuck to his pocket linings. He was more than a school friend, he wanted to say, but he knew he could not.
Toby's very bright, Mother.
Her father glanced briefly at Toby, a glance like a knife blade.
So you have told us, Zori? It is the first time you have not headed the class, so he must be remarkable.
Do sit down. We have a little time until the meal is served.
Zori perched on the chair nearest her mother. Toby, following her glance, took one two seats away, across from her father, who now sat next to his wife.
I understand that your family has had a great tragedy.
Yes, Sarah. We were attacked, across many systems. I am fortunate to be alive.
You yourself were attacked? A boy so young?
Yes, Sarah. If not for my cousin Stella, whom you've met...
I have not met her. I have only spoken with her.
Spoken with? If not for her, I would be dead. She saved my life.
Zori's mother's fingers twitched, pleating the fabric of her skirt.
And now you honor her. Now very appropriate. I understand your family had extensive holdings on several planets, especially on Slaughter Key, that you were, in fact, among the founding families there.
Yes, Sarah.
We value land, you see, not just wealth, as a sign of a family's stability. Land stays, people wander. Those who have no roots in the land are rootless. Do you not think that is so?
I suppose.
He had never thought of it that way. The Vata family owned land, yes, and some of the family farmed or ranched. But the point was always trade and profit, selling the produce of the land, transporting it to market.
Tell me, Toby, did you grow up on a planet or in space?
On a planet. My grandmother always said children need to get mud between their toes.
A quick glance passed between Zori's parents.
Oh, how quaint! You did not wear shoes, then?
Not at the beach, or at the lake.
Toby had forgotten that Cascadians did not approve of bare feet. Of course not on station, but he wondered about on planet. Surely they swam in their lakes and rivers and oceans. Zori's mother smiled at him, and for a moment he saw in her face the similarity to Zori, until now concealed by age and dress and formality. Zori had her eyes, her cheekbones, but her father's chin.
Ah, your culture's customs are less formal than ours, I believe.
Yes, Sarah.
Toby dared not say more. He'd put his foot in it already. She glanced at her husband.
Still lands. Formal or informal, there is more difference between landed families and those rootless than between formal and informal.
Zori's father stirred on his chair. Then he stood.
There is still time before our meal, Zoraeus. I will show your friend my collection of Cascadian curiosities. Come, Toby.
Zori flashed him a grin as he stood and followed her father out of the salon. Her father's office was almost as large, paneled in dark wood carved to represent vines and leaves and fruit, tree branches, even animals and birds. Translucent panels gave light that varied from green to gold, creating a forest floor ambience. Pin lights picked out some of the carvings, intensifying the illusion. Two big display cases flanked the room, their contents carefully illuminated. Shells, feathers, mineral specimens, tree cones.
These are all from our estates down planet. As you are planet-born, I thought you might like to see. I understand you have not been down planet here yet.
No, sir. Not here.
You know that we Cascadians revere trees. Our family has over 10,000 hectares of primary forest, never terraformed, and 5,000 terraformed at river running our primary home. The river provides fish, shellfish. See here.
He put an arm around Toby's shoulder and urged him toward one of the displays. Toby felt the strength in the man's arm, but it was not hostile, just vaguely uncomfortable.
Oh, those look like shells from the lake at home.
Yes, to our surprise, but I am not an ecologist, you understand. The native aquatic species build shells of calcium carbonate, and those shells are similar in shape to those of old Earth organisms, I've been told. Here's something different.
Something different had an exoskeleton with long, intricately branched spines. It was a little longer than Toby's hand.
That was from your river?
No, that was a gift that's come down through the family. I don't know where it's from, but I find it beautiful. The spines are still toxic, however long ago the creature died.
Zori's father had moved his arm to gesture. Toby eased away to look more closely at the display.
I'm sure you're wondering when I will remind you that Zori is my beloved daughter and demand that your attentions be honorable. And, in fact, I had planned to have that conversation. But I can see from your demeanor that you are an honorable young man and that you care for her very much. I see no need to threaten you.
No, sir.
Zori's father raised a finger for silence.
I would merely remind you that you are both young, and it is too soon to make binding agreements. You love her, you think, and perhaps you do. She loves you, she thinks, and perhaps she does. But many young people are in love with the idea of love and cannot yet distinguish that from the true and lasting affection that leads to a secure relationship. I believe I can trust you not to do anything foolish. can I not?
Toby hated the blush that he could feel heating his face.
Yes, sir. I will not do anything like that.
Zori has always been headstrong. Like me, perhaps. Her mother is more biddable.
In that was something that chilled, though Toby did not know what.
You will need to be the man, Toby. Do not let her have her way when it comes to foolishness. Do you understand me?
That much he understood.
I won't, Sir Luari.
Excellent. Now, tell me, I hear from Zori that you have not only good general intelligence, but outstanding ability in certain technical fields. I am aware of your cousin's patent application and the contracts to manufacture this miraculous new device that will free ships from reliance on the ISC. It has already had an influence on the market. Is it true that this was your invention?
Something, he would never be quite sure what, tied Toby's tongue for the merest instant, and Stella's advice flashed into his mind.
Not really, Sir Luari. I just noodled around a bit. It was more accidental than anything else, and others refined it.
At that moment, Toby remembered his security, but he had no idea how, without extreme discourtesy, he could ask about that now.
Huh, it would have been truly remarkable if a boy your age had invented it. Well, I think perhaps we should join the ladies now. Lunch should be on the point of service.
He reached out and ruffled Toby's hair as if Toby were still a child. Then he gave a sudden quick nod, like someone who had just taken a scull phone call.
Toby, your cousin is most insistent that your escort attend you at once. I'm sorry she did not let me know they were coming. We would have prepared food for them, of course. They are on their way now. But have you felt at all anxious here? Other than the natural anxiety of a boy meeting a girl's parents for the first time?
No, sir. Of course not. I thought Stella's precautions were excessive, and I'm sure they were not from distrust of you, but to teach me more caution.
Your cousin is wise, Toby, and I have taken no offense. The young are often incautious. Had I known about your escort, I would have arranged for their entry, of course.
Lunch, after that, was marred only by the presence of his security. Two stolid men standing against the wall, refusing to eat, while Zori and her parents and Toby consumed four delicious courses and made small talk. Zori's mother had stories of her childhood on the planet. Excursions into the country to boat or ride, parties and dances. Her face came alive as she told them. Zori's father said little but smiled fondly at Zori, even when she tried to tease him into response. After lunch, Toby hoped Zori would walk back with him, but she came only as far as the gate to the cone.
I have to talk to them. But you did very well, Toby. I know they liked you.
I was scared, until I thought of you. But I can't...
He glanced around. The security men were there, as always.
Kazeret. Kazeret Adden.
Then she was gone, walking briskly back up the passage to her home, and he led his security back out into the public areas of the station. When Toby got back to the Vata offices, Stella called him in at once.
What did you mean, leaving your security behind?
I had to. It would have been rude to be late. I was going to ask Zori's father when I got there.
But you didn't, did you?
I couldn't figure out how to do it without being rude. Besides, it was safe. I was in a private home with friends and...
Acquaintances. Just because they're respectable and rich doesn't make them friends.
Zori!
Zori is your friend. Don't bristle at me. I like her too. But she's not her parents. And it took her father a long time to unlock that gate for your security.
He said if you'd only told him beforehand that...
I did. Of course I did. He said it wasn't necessary. I said it was our policy. Think about that, Toby. Would people we want as friends lie to you?
Toby wanted to argue with her. It couldn't be true. These were Zori's parents. But Stella would not lie to him. That much he knew.
He must have had a good reason.
I'm sure he did.
Did he try to talk to you about your research?
The uneasy feeling Toby'd had in the study with Zori's father returned. He couldn't define it. He didn't want to.
I need to work on my paper.
Do that.
He could feel her gaze on his back as he went into the lab where he had left his schoolwork. A couple of hours later, Stella came in. She held out an audio cube and a printout.
Toby, do you have any linguistic analysis software that can make sense of this?
What is it?
Kai sent it. It's a recording and phonetic transcript of transmission by pirate ships. Nobody in her group can understand it, and she sent it to me. Nobody I've talked to so far has a clue. I'll send a copy to some university language departments on planet, but I don't expect much. Cascadians are pretty much monolingual, and even on the other worlds of the Confederation, they don't have much linguistic diversity.
Toby took the cube and printout and glanced at the latter.
That's odd.
What?
This word, prot, it's kind of slang.
Kid slang? I don't think the pirates would be using ordinary kid slang, and anyway, others would recognize it.
Zori said it meant something rude.
He was not about to tell Stella exactly what. She had laid down her rules about anatomical humor long before.
Zori? You learned that word from Zori?
I don't know if it's the same word exactly. It sounds like it, but there could be words in different languages that sound the same and mean something different. Vada code uses some that's standard.
I know that. But do you see anything else you recognize?
Toby and Zori just talked slang. They never wrote it down. He worked his way along the page, sounding out the words. The transcriber had used phonetic symbols he wasn't entirely familiar with.
What's this thing with the hook under it?
That's a sk sound. I think Kai's comm officer just ran this through a computer transliteration. It's all in formal linguistic symbols. Let's see. That one there, that's another consonant cluster. Kz. Do you recognize any of this?
I'm trying. Oh, wait. This one is like the word for far, or farther. This one is like prophet, with the suffix for no. And this is like out of here. And there's a now. It's... But it can't be. Just coincidence. Not this many words, can it?
Hope died with Stella's expression.
You learned all these from Zori?
It's her family's private slang. Like our Avada trade talk. That's how I know the word for prophet.
That's what she told you?
Yes. She said she learned it from her father. Her mother doesn't use it so much. He told her not to use it in public, that it was rude to talk in a language others didn't understand. But sometimes, in trade, in business, it was necessary. She wasn't supposed to teach me, but...
He looked at the page again. More words made sense now. Ship and ships. A few numbers. He had learned the numbers up to 20.
I'll have to ask Zori.
No. You will not ask Zori. You will not tell Zori about this message, and you will find a way to separate yourself from Zori and her family without fuss.
I can't do that! We just... Her family gave permission! You said...
You must. Come on, Toby, you know what this means.
I don't.
But he did, and did not want to.
She speaks... Her family speaks a language unknown to anyone else I've asked, which just happens to be the same language the pirates speak. That Gamus Turek speaks. What does that tell you?
It doesn't tell me that Zori's a pirate. Maybe somewhere back, somewhere along the way, like Osman. Maybe one of their relatives went bad. Any family can have bad people in it.
Toby, I understand.
You don't understand! Zori is not bad. She loves me and I love her. And nothing you can say will change that.
Toby flung himself out of her office, grabbed his books from the lab, and bolted for the door, his security clumping along after. Stella looked at the door Toby had tried to slam. There was something funny, or would be someday, about her, of all people, having this conversation with Toby.
Do all young people use the exact same words to their parents and guardians when they're frantic about their first love? Nothing you can say will stop me.
She remembered throwing that in her mother's face, and then her father's. The father who was dead now, only he wasn't a real father. The mother who hadn't told her the truth. She pinched the bridge of her nose hard and called Toby's escort on her skull phone.
Don't let him be alone with the Luwari girl, no matter what. Tackle him if you have to.
He's upset.
He's angry and hurt and scared and convinced she's the love of his life and I'm to blame for trying to separate them. You were young once, I assume?
Yes, I was. We'll take care of him.
Toby had dropped the cube and printout from Kai. Stella picked them up.
Pirate jargon?
She found the words Toby had mentioned.
Enough to go on?
She wrote those out in standard script, not trusting the computer at this point, security or no. Kai had recorded transmissions in a combat situation. Surely from even a few words, someone could devise a translation. Ship or ships, far or farther, now, profit, out of here.
No, out of here now.
Stella looked at the rest of the page.
What was that rude word Toby mentioned? Prot?
She looked through the rest of the printout. Prot appeared often. It was probably a cuss word. Probably, from Toby's reaction, anatomical. That wasn't going to be very helpful. When Stella got back to the apartment, Toby's security was outside.
He's studying, he says. He hasn't left the apartment. He hasn't made any calls.
Thank you.
Stella dreaded going in, starting the confrontation again. Yet more than her comfort or Toby's rested on his ability to translate the pirate jargon. She'd never considered the possibility her parents had ever dreaded talking to her. For the first time, it sank in that if she'd had that child, she would be a mother in fact, and the mother of a youngster not that much younger than Toby. The apartment was silent. Toby's door was closed. Stella moved into the kitchen and dialed a prepackaged meal. She had no doubt he would hear her moving around. As it heated, she went to his door.
Supper's almost ready.
I'm not hungry.
She knew better than that. Toby was always hungry.
Toby, I expect you to come to supper whether you eat it or not.
A long moment, then he yanked the door open. His eyes were red, his hair disheveled.
I won't eat.
That's fine. I know you're working on a paper, Toby, but this translation thing is urgent. Kai needs it. Everyone needs it. Right now, no one can tell what the pirates are planning, even if they overhear them.
She's not a pirate.
I didn't say she was. But we need to know what they're saying here, if you can figure it out.
Kai's sure this was from pirates?
Yes.
He took the paper and cube.
All right. You still want me at supper?
Yes.
As Stella expected, Toby started eating when she served his plate, his eyes darting now and then to the paper beside him.
Do we have any way to get this into standard script? I don't know all these symbols.
Yes, I've got that in my implant, and it's on most computers in the word processing section. You could upload it into yours now that you've got the adult model, but don't use an outside source.
Stella had given in to his request for the most advanced implant on the grounds that he really did need it to do the research he was doing, and she needed someone as backup for the Vata command set. Toby shoveled in the last of a serving of rice with vegetables. His lack of appetite had already dealt with a double serving of cultured turkey with gravy.
I don't know nearly as much as Zori. I don't know all the words I can even read.
We can't ask Zori.
Not even when it's this important?
That was the sticking point. It was that important. If it came to it, if it meant life or death for Kai or for planets, they would have to ask Zori. Force Zori, if it came to it, to do the translation. Or her father.
Any such request should come through official channels. I've already given a copy of this to the Cascadian government. It's their job to decide what to do with it. Though, now that I know someone knows the language, or some of it, they need to know that.
It'll get Zori in trouble. Maybe I can figure out more of it.
I hope so.